Awesome, Neil. Thank you so much for coming on. You've acquired a pretty big position at A&W. Everybody knows it's a fast food restaurant, especially here in North America. And you know, COO is if I'm not mistaken, right under CEO. Or what's the difference between COO and CEO?
Well, the CEO is the chief executive officer, so they're responsible for all aspects of the business. Legal, financial, operations, purchasing, etc. Mm-hmm. All of those are ultimately under the chief executive officer. I'm the chief operating officer, so my responsibility is in the day-to-day operation of the business. So for us, that's restaurants, but a COO in banks would be responsible for the functioning of the bank branches. In a hotel, they'd be responsible for the functioning of the hotels. So I look after specifically the day-to-day operations of the business.
Could you give me some examples that you would be in charge of over the CEO of something, of a role?
Well, generally a COO would always report to a CEO. So the CEO is kind of the head person in any organization. And in some organizations, this one, for instance, I don't go by chief operating officer. I go by vice president of operations. So, and often a CEO is known as a president and a CEO. They're at the head of the organization, and then either vice presidents or chief operating officer, chief marketing officer, chief financial officer, those positions would report up to the chief executive officer. So I'm not responsible for anything that the CEO wouldn't also be responsible for. So our CEO, Susan Senecal, she's my boss, and basically anything I'm responsible for, she's responsible for.
Interesting. And in a company, there's board members, right?
Correct.
What do those board members exactly do, and how are they, as I heard from different sources, that they're kind of in control of the CEO and the CEO's decisions, or how exactly does that work?
Yeah, I would say in all cases, a board of directors is responsible for choosing the CEO. So they have ultimate say over who will be the chief executive officer, the president of the company. That's the main function that they have in the actual operation of the business, is selecting the CEO. But a board can vary depending on the nature of the company. So in some cases, boards are very hands-on in the management of the company. And in other cases, they're more of an investment board. They're people who have invested in the company and who have money riding on it. And the CEO and the senior leadership team report regularly to the board on the progress of the business. So it really depends on the board and the senior management team how that relationship will work. In our case, our board is very helpful and very engaged in our business. They give us fantastic advice. They know things about the financial world and other things that we might not have as much experience about, so they can help us find ways to solve our problems. But they leave the day-to-day running of the business to us. So they don't act as a real management board.
Okay.
They're more of an advisory board.
Now, you said the board elects the CEO, but who decides who the board members will be? Do they also get elected, or what's the process?
Well, for us, our board members are the investors in the company itself. So they're the primary shareholders. So we're a privately held company. We're not publicly traded. Now, we do have an income trust that exists on the Toronto Stock Exchange, but the actual management and operation of A&W is a private company, not a public company. So in our case, the board is the investors. In a publicly traded company, board of directors will have a different responsibilities. And again, it does depend on the nature of the organization, whether it's a for-profit or non-for-profit. Board members can either be recruited by existing board members. They can be recruited by external people whose job it is to recruit people to sit on the board. So boards tend to be people who are very knowledgeable, very experienced in business, and who can help guide the management team in the right direction, help them make good decisions, get them access to capital if they need it, et cetera. So those are the functions that boards serve. And different companies have different ways of recruiting and hiring their board members. And some board positions are paid positions, others are unpaid positions. Again, it just depends on the nature of the organization and the industry that they're in.
Okay. You mentioned something about being privately traded, or what was...
Privately owned.
Privately owned, okay.
Yeah, so the restaurant business itself, A&W Food Services of Canada, it's not a publicly traded company, so you can't buy shares in A&W Food Services. All the shares are owned privately. In a publicly owned company, the shares are public, okay. And you can buy them and sell them on a stock exchange, you know, simply right. by day trading or hiring a broker, et cetera. So it's just a different way of organizing the company, and we've chosen to not be a public company. We've remained private.
What is the reason behind that, and are there positives and negatives to each one?
Yeah. The positive to going public is you can raise a lot of capital. So once you go public, anybody who wants to invest is able to do so, and everyone can see your portfolio, everyone can see your initial public offering, and if you are a strong company that people would consider a good investment, you'll get a lot of people who will want to buy shares in your company, and you can raise a lot of money by doing that. So often companies, when they go from being private to being public, it's because they want to rapidly expand or they want to do something that requires a lot of capital, and there's no way to raise that kind of capital other than to go public and let anybody who wants to buy your shares. Now, so that's the positive. The negative is you start to lose control, and you start to lose total control. Once you go public, now shareholders, they have rights and you have obligations to them, and you cannot necessarily always make any kind of decision for the business that you want because you have shareholders and boards and so on. So certain restrictions are placed upon a company once they decide to go public, and that's meant to protect investors and so on. It's meant to keep people right. who might have unethical desires from, you know, stealing people's money, essentially. But in the realm of operating a business, the more people you have to report to, the harder it is sometimes to move things along quickly. So those are the pros and cons. You can raise a lot of money to expand your business if you go public, mm-hmm. but now you have more people to answer to.
Right. So how is it exactly that you got to this position? What steps did you take? And did you have anybody, like mentors, who guided you and helped you in the process?
Yeah, I've been lucky. So I started probably when I was younger than you are now. I started in high school. I grew up in Regina, and so I started with a local A&W in Regina. And like lots of people who get their first job in high school, I thought, well, this will give me a little bit of spending money, and
right.
We'll see what happens. But, you know, I really liked the people that I worked with, and I really liked the work, and I really liked the industry. And as I was getting close to graduating high school, they started talking about offering me a restaurant management position. And I wasn't the world's greatest student, so I wasn't all that eager to go to university in the first place. So I thought this sounded like a pretty good opportunity. So I took it, and then I worked my way up through the restaurant management ranks. And in 1987, I came here to Vancouver into the head office. So I applied for a job, and I got it. And from there, my career has progressed through different positions within the organization, almost always in the operations end. I spent a little bit of time in marketing, but because I don't have a strong educational background per se, I didn't really know too much about the fundamentals
right.
of marketing, so I didn't spend a lot of time there. I came back to operations, and I've always enjoyed the industry, I've enjoyed the people, I've enjoyed the work, and so I've just, I guess, worked hard enough and done enough right things that people said, hey, maybe he could do something else. And so I've had all sorts of different jobs, ending with this one. So
you've also worked as a counselor for different businesses?
Well, I've served on a couple of boards. I served with Arizona State University School of Business, so an advisory board role there. And I currently serve with the BC Cancer Foundation on their board. I think Sarah Roth
was
a previous guest. Yeah. And so I work closely with Sarah and all of the board of directors at the BC Cancer Foundation. And I did for a while do a little consulting for in the hospitality industry, but that was quite a number of years ago.
What are some of the key issues you saw while consulting? You consulted with different businesses?
Yeah, predominantly in the restaurant,
hospitality
sector. And usually because I've spent all my life in operations, most of the clients that I had outside of A&W. So at the time, I had actually formally left A&W, and they were a big client of mine when I had my consulting business, but then I had a few others. And it was usually in areas of profit improvement. So the hospitality industry has very thin margins, and without proper controls and proper procedures in your restaurant or in your hotel, your profit can disappear really quickly. So I was mostly known for being able to help people really improve their profit performance in their businesses. So that's mainly how I consulted with other businesses. And fortunately, if you're in the business of making people more profit, they'll usually hire you. So that's
right.
That's the kind of thing that they're eager to do.
What are some of the issues that you've seen with these businesses regarding finances, as you said, and how did you help them climb out of that?
Well, in our business, there's really only two big cost categories. There's the food and the packaging and so on, the products that you sell, and there's the labor. And so generally, if a restaurant is struggling with their profitability, one of those two things will be higher than it should be and more than the restaurant can afford. And so there's certain, I would say, industry tips and tricks on how to maximize your efficiency in both your food cost controls and your labor cost controls. And generally speaking, I would say if you bring those into a business and they execute them well and on a consistent basis, you always see an improvement in profit. So it's one of those things where if you're not managing it every single day, it very quickly disappears. And because your profit margins are so slim, it doesn't take much in the way of a decline in your food cost control or a decline in your labor control, and pretty soon you're struggling to make money.
Mm-hmm. In high school, were there any courses that you felt drawn towards that you wanted to take, and then you thought, oh, maybe later I should take it in university or college?
History, I was always drawn to history, geography. You know, I think I'm very, very interested in the world as it is and the world as it was. I was less interested in things that I would characterize as the arts, you know, like other languages, although now that I'm the chief operating officer for a national company, I wish I'd paid more attention
right.
to French. I'd be a lot better off if I'd done that. But, you know, French and English and literature
yeah.
and even the sciences didn't interest me quite so much as, I guess I'm interested in people. And, you know, people create history, and geography tells you about how people are different in different places in the world and so on. So those are the things that really interested me in school. But to be honest, I never actually went to university and never really wanted to. So high school was something that I endured because I wanted
right.
to have a high school education, but I really never had much aspiration when I was younger to have a post-secondary education. There are times now that I look back and think that I wish I had done that, but I just wasn't, you know, school didn't sit well with my disposition. I think almost at any time if I'd have tried to pursue post-secondary education, I probably would have struggled and maybe not even seen it through, who knows. So I don't regret the choices I've made.
What would you have wished you took in university, looking back at it now, from where you are?
What do I wish?
Like, what could have helped you now? Here.
Well, a lot of things could have could have helped me along the way. I think political science is something that again, you know, I sort of like how people impact the world and how people's actions change the world and so on. So I think as I reflect on what interests me now, I'm sure I would have enjoyed political science, and I wish I knew a little bit more about how politics works and, you know, what the technical parts of it are. So I have lots of opinions about politics, as does everyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't really know too much about it, so I try to keep my mouth shut because everyone has an opinion on politics, but not a lot of people really understand how it works. So I wish I had a better understanding.
Exactly. And now that I'm just about to finish high school, I know that a lot of my classmates aren't that inclined in politics. And politics, you know, we're surviving around it. It's around us. There's no escape from it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of teens interested in politics and that want to go down the political way. What advice could you give to them? Because at the end of the day, we need them. We can't.
Yes.
Unless some AI or some technology invents something, we kind of need politics and it's going to be there.
Well, we do. And I think that's a very astute observation that you've made. And it's an opinion that I share. I do worry because what I see happening is politicians are taking the place of leaders. And I think, you know, at various times in our history, we've had fantastic leaders who also happen to be the head of countries. So, you know, Winston Churchill during the war, Brian Mulroney just passed away recently. I think a lot of Canadians would consider him a very effective leader. John Kennedy was considered a pretty effective leader in the U.S. So I think over the history of the last 100 years or so, we've had some incredible leaders as politicians, but they seem to be getting replaced by people who are just politicians and not really very good leaders. So most people that I witness, the thing that dismays me the most is that they're far too busy trying to make the other person look bad, then really focusing their attention on how they can make the situation better. So just making me blame someone else for my problems doesn't make my problems go away. And I would like to see somebody step up and say, I can make things better, and not step up and say, everything that's wrong is his fault. I don't think that's very effective leadership. I think that's very effective politicking, but I don't think it's very effective leadership. So that's a bit where my dismay with politics is. Now, again, that's a very uninformed opinion. I don't really understand politics, but I've been around for a long time, and I just think our politicians could be better leaders and maybe put some of the politics on the back burner for a while.
Right. Do you think because of such, especially looking to the U.S. right now, there's such a big divide amongst, for example, Republicans and Democrats, and all of these different political issues, there's such a big divide that it's starting to spread to different countries, and I'm starting to worry, like, where is this going to end up going? Are we going to have, like, for example, in the U.S., are they going to have, like, a two-state solution, like, Republicans here, Democrats here, this view's here, this view's here. But then again, I don't think that'd be a very a good functioning society if we just keep dividing up people. So in your opinion, how could we fix something like that?
Well, I think we need to, again, focus less on the things that divide us and focus less on the politics of fear and blame and really act like partners. And, you know, nations that have democratic values, there will be winners and losers in every election, and the winner represents everyone, whether they voted for them or not, And the loser is expected to do their level best to help the government that did win run a highly functioning country. And I just don't see that being very prevalent anymore. Again, I see politicians acting like politicians. They want to be in office for their own reasons, whether it's personal gain, personal pride, I don't know. But I don't see a lot of behavior from our politicians which suggests any of them really have the nation's best interests at heart. So that's what worries me. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but I would say to the folks that listen to your podcast, if you are losing faith in what you see in the political situation, I would urge you to do something about it by participating, not by backing away. Because people who see something that they don't believe is right and that they believe needs to be better, if they do nothing, they're actually promoting the way it is now rather than the way they want it to be. So, I hope that young people will be inspired to enter politics and inspired to take on leadership roles and bring their thoughts and ideas and values to the public arena so that we can have good leaders again and that we do have people who will be courageous and act with the country's best interest
right.
at heart, not just their own best interest. And, you know, really, this sounds corny, but we're all citizens of the country. If the country gets better, we all benefit by that. So,
exactly.
You know, politicians who only worry about themselves aren't ever going to be good for the country, in my opinion.
Okay, fun theoretical question here. If, let's say, 50 years down the line, no one wants to become a politician anymore, the government is slowly, because not enough interest in the government, everything is slowly falling from that end, what would be an alternative? Just an interesting theoretical question.
Well, I think history can teach us a few lessons. Wherever there is a power vacuum, someone will show up and fill it. And they will usually be the worst of the worst. They will be the people who are literally only concerned with themselves, willing to take whatever they can from anyone they can. You know, they're the worst form of leaders that you can imagine, dictators or autocrats or whatever you want to call them. And wherever there's a vacuum of power, it will get filled, and so that's what would happen. So I think gradually over time, if good, strong, right-thinking, powerful leadership type people moved away from holding public office or trying to influence the political landscape, then that would create a power void and it would be filled by somebody who would not be what, by today's standards, we consider a democratic, duly elected leader. So when no one's in power, someone will seize it. That's always going to be the case.
So if you don't mind, we'll move a bit to more A&W.
Sure.
And it's restaurant. So how many locations does A&W have?
Just shy of 1,060.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And that is all over everywhere?
No, that's just Canada. So we're Canada. Yeah, we're completely separate from the U.S.
How many in the U.S. do you know?
I don't know offhand. We have a cordial relationship with them, but not really a business.
But I assume more than 1,000.
No. Actually, I think I'm estimating here, but I'm going to say somewhere in the 700 to 800 range.
Oh.
And so when you consider their population is 10 times what ours is,
we're
a much bigger deal in Canada than they are in the U.S. Now, there is international, Southeast Asia, predominantly Singapore, Philippines, those kinds of countries in Southeast Asia. They have a strong A&W presence there as well.
Oh, okay.
And that's owned by the U.S. Version of A&W. But Canada and the U.S. are completely separate.
So if that's owned by the U.S., what other countries A&Ws did we sponsor?
in does the Canadian company
yes.
own it? None.
None. Only no. Canada.
Yeah, only Canada.
Is there a reason for that?
We've always had more opportunity in Canada than we can even keep up with. If we could find ways to grow faster, we would. Building restaurants takes a lot of time and permits and,
right.
everything about it. So, but we've always had more opportunity in Canada than we could even capitalize on. So we would just spread ourselves thin if we started looking outside of Canada.
I see.
So at some point, we may change that. You may say, we can't really open all that many more restaurants in Canada, so if we want to keep growing, we have to look to another country, but we're not there yet.
Okay. In Canada, where would you think the next expansion could be?
Ontario and Quebec and Atlantic Canada are three regions that remain underdeveloped for us. When McDonald's first came to Canada in the 1960s and early 1970s, those were the areas where they focused on growing really rapidly. And mm-hmm. we were still a drive-in chain back then. So McDonald's came in, they were new, they were modern, they were fast, they were all the things that they still are today. And we were a drive-in business that was small, and some of them were already 20 years old at the time. So McDonald's really almost put us out of business in the late 60s, early 70s. And so we had to close a number of restaurants to kind of consolidate our strength. And we consolidated our strength in Western Canada. And we closed a large number of restaurants in Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada. And then it was many, many years before we built up enough strength and momentum in our own business to go back into those markets. Mm-hmm. So we were late arriving there. McDonald's had basically taken over and kicked us out, and so we've been playing catch up in those markets ever since.
Still to this day, you guys
still
are still
to this
trying.
Day, yeah.
Okay. What other areas has, for example, McDonald's, I would say, is one of, or probably the biggest.
Yep.
What are some of the things, some key points that you guys are trying to catch up with McDonald's on? Like, is it the way they, make the burger, or what?
Well, I would say locations, number of locations.
Okay.
So their footprint continues to be much larger than ours. And, again, because they sort of changed fast food. We were considered fast food when we were a drive-in restaurant. But, that meant you'd get your food in 10 minutes. So, and that was, at the time, considered fast. Then McDonald's came in and a minute became fast food. So they really changed and revolutionized the industry and really built it into what it is today. And so they've got a head start not just on us, but virtually on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the world changes and people change how they eat and how they want to access restaurants, McDonald's is always on the leading edge of that. They're further ahead than everyone else. So whether it's a mobile app or it's delivery, they're always a leader, and in some ways we like that because we can come along right on their heels. We don't have to be the first ones into the market and make all of the mistakes that you make when you're the first one to market. We can watch what they do and learn and adapt it to us. And I think others do that, Wendy's and Burger King as well. So, and in that way, we're in a strange way sort of grateful to McDonald's because they often show the way to the rest of us, but they're so much larger than everyone else that they're the only ones who can do that, really.
I see. Are you guys friends with McDonald's or Burger King?
I wouldn't say friends.
Do you guys bounce ideas back and forth? Or
no.
Are you guys separate and hate each other?
Well, we don't hate each other. I think that would... We're competitors.
Right.
So we're trying to take their market share, and they're trying to take our market share, because market share always adds up to 100%, and if they have 50,
yes,
in order for us to get more market share, somebody else has to lose some. That's just how market share works. But we're members of different associations, the Canadian Restaurant Association, the Canadian Franchise Association. So there are industry associations that they belong to and that we belong to. And I personally find McDonald's to be very, very good corporate citizens with respect to these associations. They're interested in seeing the restaurant industry be a strong, vital industry. They're interested in seeing quick service restaurants be strong, vital businesses, as are we. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why you join those associations. So, you know, it is kind of like two boxers. When you're in the ring, you're trying to beat the other one up. But that doesn't mean you hate each other or you don't want the sport of boxing to get better and grow and so on. So that's how I would characterize the relationship. Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, why do you think people say that all these fast food restaurants are unhealthy? Because from what I've read online, people look at it as just lettuce, the beef patty, some mayo, and the bun. Mm-hmm. Why do people have a negative connotation towards it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have the answer to. You know, but there are some things that are staples in our business. Soft drinks, for instance, which have, you know, fallen a little bit out of favor over the last several years. I mean, high sugar content is something that people are starting to move away from. So I think there's some basis in fact when you say, what do quick service hamburger restaurants sell a lot of? Soft drinks is one of them. So you can point to that and say people could eat healthier. And honestly, you know, we've been introducing juice and water and other healthier options for people who want to make those choices. So I think it's a bit unfair, but there are some things on our menu that if you were fanatical about healthy eating, you wouldn't drink soft drinks. You know, wouldn't have some of those things. So I think, like anything, once it starts attracting a bit of attention, then the legend grows faster than maybe reality.
I see.
Suggests it should be. So again, I sometimes feel a little bit like it's an unfair characterization, but it is what it is. If that's how people perceive quick service right. restaurants, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It means you have to respond to how they perceive you. And so, you know, we've done that with Beyond Meat, and we've done it by increasing the amount of chicken that we have. We've done it again mm-hmm. by introducing soft drinks, or not soft drinks, but beverages that have less sugar, et cetera. So those are the things that you have to do, because you can't make people think something or make them believe something just because you want them to. So you've got to look at what they already believe and then try to provide them with the things that meet their needs.
And this would be every single fast food restaurant. Me and my friends, we were talking about this, and the only restaurant that we wouldn't consider fast food would be Subway. And we're like, why would we consider Subway not fast food, but all these other restaurants fast food? And to a person who watches its fitness and watch what it eats, wouldn't go to that as a healthy option. So we came to the conclusion that, I did some research in this, I was just curious, and a lot of people were complaining about canola oil, and all these restaurants are using canola oil. And I started digging deeper, and I found that, now this study, I don't know, it could be debunked. I haven't looked, I just saw a study and I skimmed through it, and it said that canola oil, there's been a few studies that show that canola oil leads to brain plaque, which later leads to like Alzheimer's or all of this. Again, this could be completely debunked now, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But we were also thinking, like, all these fast foods, they're competing against each other, whoever has the most sales. And as you mentioned, McDonald's is up there. Would it be a consideration to maybe take out the community's biggest worries about it? For my example, would be the canola oil, and replace with some better oil, and that would be your marketing, or restaurant's marketing, saying, we're a bit healthier than that McDonald's, mm-hmm. and you know, like, come to us now.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got a good potential career in marketing ahead of you. That is exactly how smart businesses go about it. And the reality is people's perceptions and their needs and their eating habits and their desires, those change over time. And, you know, as they do, businesses have to change to keep up with them. And, you know, I'm not familiar with the study you were talking about with canola oil, so I don't know anything about the science of canola oil. I can't speak to that. But when I began my career, we used shortening, you know, beef tallow shortening.
What is that?
Well, it's like lard. It's basically made from the fat of animals.
Okay.
And then you would fry in that. So it wasn't pure animal fat.
Okay.
But and that became associated with some health concerns like, I think, cholesterol and things like that. So the industry in general, as a whole, moved away from that and moved towards vegetable oils, or grain oils, which now include canola. And again, I'm unfamiliar with the study that you said, but if consumer response to canola oil got so that they didn't want it as part of their diet, then I guarantee that all restaurants, anyone frying anything in canola oil, would be falling over themselves to find a replacement because, you know, businesses essentially are there to solve customers' problems, and when they solve the customer's problem, the customer will pay them. That's the very nature of a business. And if what you're offering doesn't solve the customer's problem, they won't come to you. So, and again, then it becomes a race and who's going to position themselves and who's going to be the first one to find the alternative. And the ones who do, they're the first ones to start capitalizing on it, and they'll make a big positive impact with customers, and customers will come to them, and then everyone else will catch up. That's just the ongoing, never-ending cycle of business, really. You just described it very well.
I see. So from my understanding, A&W is, like, all their restaurants are franchises?
Almost all.
Almost all.
A small handful are corporate, but yeah.
How exactly does a franchise work?
Well, that's a good question. So we own the trademarks, we own the name of the hamburgers, we own the recipe, we own the root beer formula, we own the, you know, we have all these trademarks, and then we have a manner in which you can operate an A&W restaurant and do so successfully and profitably. And so we basically sell those things to a franchisee. So a franchisee actually owns the restaurant. In some cases, they own the land the restaurant is on. And they pay to build the building, and they pay to buy the equipment. So they're basically a restaurant owner. And when they go to open the restaurant, we let them put our signs on the building. We let them put our menu items up on their menu board. We give them our recipes. We teach them how to run an A&W restaurant so that they can do it successfully and profitably. And then in exchange, and then we give them rights to all of that for 20 years. And in exchange for that, they pay us a small portion of the sales that they create. So if you wanted to be a restaurateur and you were a great chef and you were a genius with food and so on, you probably wouldn't join a franchise because you'd want to create your own menu and have your own creations and so on. But if you're an entrepreneur and you want to be in business for yourself, but you don't really know everything about food and everything about running a restaurant, that's what makes a franchise appealing, because when you join A&W, you automatically get to sell products that everyone knows. Recipes aren't something you have to create yourself. They're given to you. The sign has value. People know who A&W is. So all of those things have value to you as a business person, and in exchange, you pay us a small portion of your sales.
I see.
But if you were just to put up Matthew's Hamburgers, a sign that said Matthew's Hamburgers, you'd be far less likely to be successful than if you put up an A&W sign.
Right.
So we bring credibility, brand awareness, and expertise, and in exchange, our franchisees pay us.
The profits that these franchise owners give to you is obviously far less smaller than if you guys were to operate and run the A&W, correct?
Correct.
So what incentive does it give you guys to franchise instead of you guys running it and gaining as much profit as possible?
Faster growth. So if we have to build them all and staff them all and manage them all ourselves,
makes sense.
We can't go very fast. But once you start, and it's much like we talked about with a public versus a private company. If you were to own all the restaurants yourself, you'd be the equivalent of a private company. But that means you move a whole lot slower. When you franchise, it's more like a public company because you open yourself up to all these other people who are willing to invest in your brand and who can help you open restaurants much more quickly than you'd be able to on your own.
I see. And this would work with companies and corporations that have a lot of locations everywhere.
Correct.
And there's more demand for them, and they'd, okay.
Correct. And generally, when you see national chains, they're either franchised or licenses. So the chain licenses to business owners the right to use the company name, use the logos, use the products, et cetera, et cetera. So muffler shops, anything that's national, they would either be likely franchising or licensing.
Okay. Sorry, and what was licensing?
Well, licensing would be slightly different than a franchise. Service stations, for instance, gas stations. There's quite a number of gas stations in Canada where just an individual will own the land and will have the gas tanks under the ground and have the gas pumps and have the service station and so on. And then Esso or Petro-Canada or Shell will try to recruit them to sell their gas. So this is an independent station operator, and they'll become a licensee of one of the major gas companies because, again, if you put up Matthews service station, you're probably going to sell a lot less gas than if you put up a Petro-Canada sign, because now that you've got a Petro-Canada sign, people have their loyalty cards. Yes. And so on and so forth. So that's called a licensee arrangement. You're okay. Not franchising from Petro-Canada. You've already got the restaurant and the operation and so on, and it's all you're doing is flying their banner and serving their gas or their product. And so a licensing arrangement is slightly different than a franchising arrangement, but basically it's the same thing.
And how many A&Ws are owned under corporation?
10.
10, only 10. Why do you guys hold on to those and not give them off as franchises?
Well, it's important to be in the business you're in. So,
That's fair. Yeah.
We have 1,050 franchisees who count on us to make decisions and develop the brand and grow the brand, and we can make better decisions and do things more wisely when we actually own some ourselves. But it also keeps us close to emerging opportunities or emerging challenges. So again, we work very collaboratively with our franchisees, and if they start to see opportunities, they look to us to help them capitalize on that. And if they're having struggles, they look to us to help them get through those. And we can sometimes see those coming a little bit in advance because we own a few restaurants ourselves. If we didn't own them, we would probably be slower to respond to opportunities and slower to respond to problems.
I see. So it keeps you guys in the loop, keeps you guys in the business, updated on everything. Interesting. What advice would you have for teenagers who want to achieve a high position in whatever company they want to achieve that high position in? What would you advise them to do, and how could they maybe get there faster than someone without this advice?
Okay, well let me think. I'll just talk about working for a national company because that's what I've done all my life, and I think most national companies will be somewhat similar to A&W in terms of how the business operates. Is that what you see when you drive past an A&W? Or when you drive past a Royal Bank or a Midas muffler, anytime you go past a national chain, what you see is not the full extent of what that company has to offer to potential employees. So, you know, you think of a bank as just being tellers and maybe a bank manager and a couple of mortgage brokers. But within the Royal Bank system, there are people in advertising, people in marketing, people in accounting, people in human resources. These are very large organizations with hundreds and in some cases thousands of employees in all sorts of different functions within the company. So, you know, right here in this office, there are people who are professional purchasers, and there are people who are accountants and financial people and payroll people and human resource specialists, and there's architects and project managers. So, you know, there's multiple opportunities in large large national companies. So okay. What you see is not is only a small slice of what the organization actually is. So I think in national companies, they provide a lot of opportunity in a lot of different fields. So they don't look all that glamorous from the street, but they can be really lucrative and rewarding career paths. And my advice would be if you were going to choose a path like that, if you were going to try and get on with a national company, something that's, you know, a big chain and has lots of opportunity, my advice would be very early on you'll know whether you love the business and love the work, because you have to love both. Sometimes people fall in love with computers or food or maybe the glamour of hotels. They fall in love with the industry or the business, but you gotta love the work too. So if you love hotels and you start as a somebody who cleans the rooms, you should love that work. If you don't love that work, and I don't care where you start or what job you start, if you don't find that you love the work and love the business, you've probably made a bad choice. And I see a lot of people who like the business but don't like the work. And you just can't have the kind of success. If you want to move up, you want to be highly successful, you want to make an impact on the organization that you work with, you've got to love both the work and the industry. And if you don't, I would advise you not to stick around there for very long, because you can fall into a routine and the next thing you know, 10 years have gone by and you're still working in a place where the future that you hope for isn't ever going to happen. So when you find that you love the work and you love the business, you're on to something.
Okay. Awesome. Wise words. Now, as we begin to wrap up here, because I know I got to go in a little bit, why was A&W named A&W?
Well, it's after the founders. They were California in 1919.
Okay.
Allen and Wright.
Oh, just okay.
They were the
just
founders.
Like
yeah.
Cool. And why are the colors are orange and black?
Orange and brown.
Orange and brown. Why is it orange and brown?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't, if there's a particular reason behind that, I'm unaware of it.
Was root beer invented by A&W?
I don't think so. I think root beer existed in some form. Now, A&W root beer was invented. That's how Allen and Wright started, with a root beer stand in a place Lodi, California.
They just sold root beers,
yeah,
no food? Oh.
In 1919. So they just opened a little roadside stand. People were the automobile was just emerging in 1919. You know, most people wouldn't have had a car then. And so they invented this root beer recipe. But I don't think they were the first one. You know, they had their own particular recipe.
I see.
But I don't think they invented
root beer. But they
jumped
off someone.
Okay. Yeah, so I think... And again, I can't be certain of this, but I think root beer was already a known entity, and this was just a variation on the recipe.
Interesting.
And they became very popular, and so then they started to sell food, and that was very popular, and it just grew from there.
To 1,060 locations?
Yeah, 1,060 locations in Canada.
Wow. And then right before we wrap up here, What is your favorite book and your favorite podcast that might have helped you or potentially could help someone else listening?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm not much of a podcaster, so I don't really listen to podcasts.
All good.
But I've read lots of books, and kind of my favorite business book is called From Good to Great. And it was a couple of folks who wanted to know what was different about companies who were good for a long time and then all of a sudden took off, like really accelerated.
Okay.
And they were very careful about selecting companies who had been very good for a very long time, mm-hmm. without ever having that rapid acceleration, and then that suddenly took off. And so it was a very insightful book.
And that book answers that pivotal point to what
happened? It was a long time ago that I read the book, so okay. I'm a bit fuzzy on my memory's a bit fuzzy on the specifics. But they give you like five or six characteristics.
Interesting, okay.
And they look at five or six different companies who all followed that same trajectory. So before they even started to look at what companies they would profile, they determined the criteria. So they determined the criteria of what good to great would look like, mm-hmm. and then they started to look. So that way they didn't get influenced, you know, by any early indication that maybe McDonald's or IBM or Microsoft, they had no idea which companies would qualify. They came up with the criteria first, and then they came up with the companies. And they found some amazing similarities among all of these companies that followed that trajectory. So it was a very good, interesting business read. On a more personal level, I think I told you I really like history. And I can't remember the title. I've loaned the book to somebody and they haven't returned it yet. But it was about Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General when John Kennedy was President of the United States. They were brothers, of course. And then John Kennedy was assassinated. Robert Kennedy, a few years later, started his own presidential run, and while that was going on, he was assassinated. So, you know, it's a very tragic set of circumstances. But it was about the metamorphosis of Robert Kennedy and how he went from this crusading, he was part of the communist trials. You know, there was a period of time in the late 50s in the U.S. where they were very nervous about communism and basically were persecuting people who they believed to have communist ideas. It was very undemocratic, very unpleasant. And he was a very active participant in that. But as he got older, he started to realize that there was a change that needed to come about in American society. And he was the Attorney General for his brother's presidency. And then he had aspirations to become president. But at the same time, he encouraged this revolution, this change that was happening with young people in America. And every time they would start to question the Vietnam War or question what the government was doing, it created problems for him. He was part of the government, and that kind of activity creates problems for the government, gets in their way, it becomes a problem for them.
Right.
And so he had to deal with those problems, but at the same time, he respected and admired and knew that this had to happen. And so he was sort of doing everything he could to encourage it, even at the same time that he had to clean up the problems that arose because of it. So it was a very interesting leadership paradox, and you know, something that just the idea of doing that is something I really admired. So some people, I'm sure, will have reasons to dislike the Kennedys, and I don't have a political position on it. I just thought it was a very interesting leadership thing to, on one hand, be encouraging this agitation and this need for change, while at the same time being the person who was most negatively affected by it when it happened.
Right. Interesting. Well, definitely check that out. Well, I appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And it feels like I'm working my way up to now the Vice President of Operations.
Correct.
At A&W. That sounds great. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Matthew.